Okay, I'm going to start with a few introductory comments. You can continue to take your test if you can do two things at once, and in the modern era, we can all do two things at once. This is the eighth year that we've offered this course to the NIH community. We've actually offered it also in a condensed version in 27 different venues around the world, from Africa to Asia to Latin America. We've attempted here to distill the essence of research ethics and to bring in a whole host of wonderful and marvelous speakers. Part of the goal here is to have everyone thinking about and trying to understand what it means to conduct research ethically. We have four major goals for the course. The first is obviously to inform you about what we consider to be the major ethical issues related to doing clinical research, how to understand and analyze and resolve some key ethical issues in a more coherent and systematic way than you might have done before. We want you to have sources to consult. I want to emphasize this CD has all the readings on it, including the supplemental readings. It really is an invaluable resource. It's up to date. This book, available in the bookstore, is a collection that we put together as a result of this course and has some additional readings in it that you might find very useful. I want to emphasize that the reading list you have is slightly out of date. If you go to the web, it's updated, mainly for Dr. Gross, the third speaker on conflict of interest today. But the CD is absolutely pristine perfect. So the thing which you're going to take away and hopefully use over time has all the appropriate readings. Not every ethical issue has simple answers to it. And part of what we want you to be able to do is to actually think through problems, to try to understand them and to really isolate what the key issues are and think through how you might resolve them and why you might resolve them. And finally, one of the most important things for you is to make you aware of resources, people, as well as other things like this book that you can consult if you have a issue. Course program over the next few weeks are mainly lectures, but we have asked all speakers to allot time to questions because they're very important. Many of the speakers will be available during the breaks. We also want to consolidate your understanding and not just have it passive, you're sitting there listening to us, but active. So we have three, I think, IRBs, mock IRBs, where you will have a protocol. You are going to act like the IRB. You're going to have to read it. You're going to have to analyze what the ethical issues, and you're going to discuss it here. The first one occurs on October 10th. It's an absolutely fascinating randomized trial involving manic depressive disorder and new treatments for it, and I will be hosting that mock IRB. You'll get the protocol. You have to read it beforehand, and if people aren't lively and participating, you can count on the fact that I will identify you and ask you to answer some questions. As I said, the IRB, these mock IRBs are very useful. They give you a chance to see how to implement what we're talking about, and they also are great cases at the cutting edge that raise really pertinent issues. We have assembled an all-star list of lecturers. As I said, we've done this for 9 years, and we do it internationally, and every one of the lecturers is an absolute international leader in their area. This is the best and the brightest on research ethics in our view, they are really worth listening to. I know that 8:30 every Wednesday for 7, 8 weeks, whatever it is might seem unholy, might even seem unethical to you. We're not beyond coercion for good, important information, and I think we've learned that that's the price to pay for having you understand and trying to get it. We will have a break around about 10:30, 10:40 each Wednesday morning. There will be some tea and coffee and cookies out there. Past experience is any prediction of the future. Many of you will take that opportunity to leave. All I can say is you will be missing a lot of good material. Some of the mock IRBs, some great lectures like today, Carrie Gross talking about conflict of interest, which is near and dear to all of our hearts. So I urge you not to use that opportunity to leave, but to come in, because we really do have standout educational activities after that. During the course of this program, probably our most popular and maybe the most important session we have is a panel of patients who participated in clinical research at the NIH. It's probably the most important session because it gives you an opportunity to interact and listen to people who participated in research and understand the research experience from their eyes. They almost invariably have something interesting and important and informative to say to you, something that you might not understand even though you interact with research participants every day of your activities here. This sign slide gives you the CME, CEU credits. There are credits available for the whole course. We need you to sign in every day that you show up so that we can account. That's what the education office makes us do. That's also the purpose behind the pretest and the post-test. We're not grading you. You don't get a letter grade. This is for your educational benefit. But you do have to sign in. We can't give you retroactive credit if you say, I was there, but I didn't sign in. We really do need you to do that. We have three distant learning sites that are taking this course, Frederick and a couple of others. And in the past, we broadcast out to Peru and to Washington State, where people have been listening. And I can assure you, if you think this is an unholy hour, just imagine if you were in Seattle. So I think that's all the things I have to raise. Are there any questions, process, procedures? During the whole session and certainly during the break, our staff members will be out there. If there's any problems or issues, please raise them with our people. Let me also say, we do need your CME evaluations, the evaluations of the course. We take them very seriously in terms of how to change things. Not everything is open to change just because of the limitations we have. But we will try to, we do listen to what goes well and what doesn't go well. Okay? Hearing no questions, I'll proceed. I came to the NIH 10 years ago, and I had literally never written an article on research ethics before they hired me. You might consider that malpractice on the part of my boss. But I was immediately confronted by this question. What makes clinical research ethical? Many people around here expected me to be an expert. I wasn't, and one of the things I had to do was to think through what was it that made research ethical. Now, lots of people were talking about informed consent. Some people thought it was compliance with the Ten Commandments. Some people thought it was IRB review. Some people thought it was informed consent and IRB review. I heard a lot of talk about compliance with Nuremberg, Helsinki, and Belmont. Compliance with 45 CFR, and I had no idea what that meant. Could have been all of the above. There's a lot of chatter in the hall about the common rule. Again, I had absolutely no idea. What was the common rule? The golden rule for plebeians, rules that are shared among IRBs, the Ten Commandments, a bridge for clinical researchers, the federal rules regulating the conduct of clinical research. So I actually had to think about, from the ground up, being trained as a philosopher, what I wanted to do is to go to the foundations and not to be encumbered by what had necessarily been written before. I also, interestingly, had come from a cancer institute. I am an oncologist, and this case was fresh in my mind because it had just arisen for me. And we're going to discuss it now and come back to it at the end. BY is a 46-year-old postmenopausal mentally disabled woman with LCAS. For those of you who aren't into cancer, that's lobular carcinoma in situ, that are malignant cells that haven't broken through, but that have a very high rate of predicting that the patient will develop cancer in the future. So she's at extremely high risk for subsequent development of cancer. The caregivers from the home where she stayed had the power of attorney for health care decisions. They brought her to the cancer center where I was working for enrollment in what was then known as the STAR trial, which was a randomized trial of two different drugs, tamoxifen and raloxifene, for the prevention of breast cancer in high-risk women. At this time, it was known that tamoxifen could prevent the development of breast cancer, although it had a moderately high risk of uterine cancer and some other bad side effects, including blood clots. BY fulfilled all the entry criteria, but she obviously could not consent because she was mentally disabled. The physician, yours truly, who saw her, wanted the IRB to reconsider the subject selection criteria for the STAR trial, and I asked the IRB to debate the question of whether it was ethical to enroll a mentally incompetent patient in a phase 3 randomized chemo prevention trial. So that's the question that I asked them to think about. As you know, I am a government employee. My views don't represent these characters. They certainly haven't seen the slides. I'm not sure they would approve of the slides, especially this one. But you guys are a little slow. It's early in the morning still. Next time, bring the coffee. So the first question you might ask, and certainly a lot of clinical researchers challenge us with all the time, is why do we need ethical guidelines for human subjects research? What is the reason we have these special ethical guidelines and they seem to grow every year? And I want to suggest to you that there are two reasons, one historical and one that is purely ethical, that is unrelated to the history. The history may or may not begin with this guy, James Lind, who was a surgeon in the British Royal Navy. And Lind is famous because he did an evaluation of different interventions for scurvy, which was a real problem for the British Navy. He took 12 sailors who were suffering from scurvy, put them into six groups, and tried a different treatment on each of the six groups. And through that, he actually learned that lemons and oranges could prevent scurvy in the British sailors, and that's why they then subsequently stocked British ships with barrels of limes, and British sailors were known as limeys. 1767 was another important year. William Watson was a physician at the Foundling Hospital in London, and in the early 1700s, 1720 to be exact, several people had developed techniques in England and the United States of inoculating smallpox, that is, taking the pus from smallpox patients and putting it onto patients who had been uninfected and making them immune. And he sought to test two claims related to smallpox inoculation. One claim was the question, was preparing patients with purgatives beneficial to taking the smallpox? That is, if you made them throw up incessantly, was it better for them to become immune and less likely that they would suffer serious harm, including death? And two, what was the best source of the inoculum? What is it, an early pox, a late pox that had crusted over? So he actually took 31 children. He gave the first 10 mercury and jalap, a very strong laxative and purgative. 10 senna and syrup of roses, which was much more mild, and 11 no medication at all. All were living together, had the same diet, similar clothes, played in the same field, slept in the same dormitories. He took a pus from the same early pox and then infected them all. And he had a quantitative endpoint, which was everyone knew that the more pox you had, the worse your smallpox. So he counted the number of pox on each child. Watson's experiment was remarkable because it was a deliberate study design. He had controls which he matched subject for subject. He controlled their environment and circumstances. They lived together. They had the same diet. And he had a quantitative endpoint. Now, many people consider this clinical science and the birth of clinical science about 250 years ago now. Now, there had been experiments before. I gave you James Lind. But this was a very well thought out and quantitative research study. I'm not going to go through the whole history, including Jenner's study and Waterhouse's study of vaccines for smallpox and other things. I'm going to fast forward to Semmelweis, who some of you may know was a researcher, a Hungarian working in Vienna, and he noticed that there was a very high rate of maternal infection and death after delivery. And he noticed that the obstetricians would go to the delivery room right out of the pathology suite with their hands covered in pathological muck, whereas the midwives had a much lower rate of maternal death and that they did not come from the pathology suite. And so he suspected that the dirty hands had something to do with things. He developed a chlorinated lime to sterilize hands before delivery. He showed that if the obstetricians did this, it prevented puerperal fever, maternal infections, and deaths, and that there was a huge decline in maternal death rate as a result of this intervention. Now, you might assume that doctors, being very empirical, quantitative, seeing this data, would immediately adopt this. Far from it. The Viennese doctors made fun of Semmelweis. He was driven out of Vienna, and 3 years later, he died in a mental institution. Now, there's many things that overlay. There's recently a very nice historical book about this. He was a Jew in Vienna, and he was an upstart, and so that may have had something to do with the fact that his sterilization was not adopted and really waited for Lord Lister. Fast forward to 1898, Fibiger in Denmark treats every other patient with anti-diphtheria serum to establish suitable controls in research, again, thinking about how to control for these studies. Joseph Goldberger, public health service giant in the early part of the 20th century, is looking at pellagra. He conducts a comparative study of diet at four orphanages, two in Georgia, two in Alabama, trying to look at whether changing the diet, in fact, can solve pellagra, and shows that if you change off a diet based mainly on corn, add some vegetables and meat, you can prevent pellagra. But this is also an important study for looking at captive populations and orphans. 1938, probably the first placebo-controlled trial of cold vaccines. 1948, the first modern randomized placebo-controlled trial, just imagine, only 60 years ago, done for streptomycin and TB in Britain. And 10 years ago, the BMJ, the British Medical Journal, had a very nice whole issue devoted to this trial and some of the ethical issues related to it. Coeval with that history of research and the development of clinical research is also a history of ethics. The first recorded mention of consent related to medicine occurs in 1767 in a British lawsuit of Slater versus Baker and Stapleton. Now, Slater was a guy who had broken his leg, but it had healed not quite straight. Baker and Stapleton were two surgeons, and they rebroke his leg to get better alignment. Slater sued, claiming that he had not given them permission. The judge in the case wrote, "It appears from the evidence of the surgeons that it was improper to disunite the callus without consent. This is the usage and law of surgeons." Now, notice what the judge is saying here. The usage and law, the common practice and the rules for surgeons, means you can't embark on a procedure without the consent of the person. Consent is not something that started yesterday. It's not something that started after Nuremberg. It's something that's been core to medicine forever. As a matter of fact, if you read Plato, he even refers to doctors for free men have to ask their consent before initiating a therapy. Now, those of you who are awake at this early hour will realize that this is clinical medicine, not clinical research. But arguments for the importance of consent prior in clinical research are not, again, very recent phenomena. They go back over 100 years to really the time when clinical research was becoming standardized and much more common. In 1892, an oncological surgeon doing research on cancer, Dr. Coley, was developing a method to induce inflammation near a cancer, hoping that the immune system would control and fight the cancer. So he was inducing artificial erysipelas in patients after their cancer surgery. And he describes in a paper how he had one patient who had a large sarcoma in his abdomen who he operated on and wanted to put him in this trial, and the patient resisted. And he talks about how over 2 weeks he talked with the patient and finally persuaded him, and only after the patient agreed did he start the trial. But the most important event two centuries ago, in the 19th century, relates to yellow fever. You'll hear more about that in the second lecture today. But I want to review some of the details because it's important for my point. In 1897, an Italian researcher working in Latin America had announced that he had discovered the bacillus of yellow fever, and by giving the bacillus to five patients had produced yellow fever in these five patients. Now, leave aside the fact that some of you know it, bacillus does not cause yellow fever. But after Pasteur and Koch, people were looking for infectious agents that caused diseases everywhere. After that, William Osler, who at the time was the chief of medicine at Johns Hopkins, just a couple of years before he had gone to Oxford as the Regius Professor of Medicine, got up at a meeting and condemned Sonnarelli in the following terms: "To deliberately inject a poison of known high degree of virulency into a human being, unless you obtain that man's sanction, is not ridiculous, it's criminal." Now here is the most important physician getting up and saying that if you do research on someone, especially dangerous research, and you don't get their sanction or their consent, right, you are not simply reckless, right, you're criminal. You're behaving unethically and illegally. Now, that episode weighed heavily on Walter Reed when he was sent to Cuba to try to find the cause of yellow fever. And he was made head of the Yellow Fever Board by the Surgeon General Sternberg. And prior to the experiments, he had to think about how to do research with a deadly disease. And he developed what we could see are five safeguards for the research. One was self-experimentation. The people on the Yellow Fever Board would participate. Now, Walter Reed didn't because he was called back to Washington, but it should be remembered that one of the people on the board was actually the only person to die in these experiments, Jesse Lazar, who had just graduated from Johns Hopkins, was a physician stationed down in Havana, and there's actually a nice plaque in the dome if you go up to Johns Hopkins to him, that there would be written agreements with other subjects, contracts, forerunner of our signed informed consents, payment in gold to those people who participated, and if they died, payment to their family with a bonus, restrictions to adult subjects. You don't do something on kids before you do it on adults. And using the phrase in all the journal articles that they published, with his full informed consent. Again, a forerunner of our statements in our method sections that say, you know, an IRB approved this study and all the patients gave informed consent. Now, subsequent to this, there's, again, a big history, which I'm not going to go over. The Nuremberg trials and the formulation in the legal decision of the Nuremberg Code. And the Nuremberg Code, the judges wrote in that decision, contains certain basic principles that must be observed in order to satisfy moral, ethical, and legal concepts. The first and longest principle they have goes on about the voluntary consent of the human subject being absolutely essential for the research. Now, I think that there are serious problems with the Nuremberg Code and that it made informed consent critical to the Nazi experiments and to the ethical condemnation of that. But my personal view is that's a mistake because it heavily emphasizes informed consent. And even if you had informed consent for those trials, they wouldn't have been ethical. They had coerced subjects. They had unfavorable risk-benefit ratio, including death as an endpoint. In particular, trying to kill patients, not trying to, but actually killing patients in the research. That makes them unethical, even if you got informed consent. In 1953, the World Medical Association began working on its own code of ethics for human subjects research. It took them 11 years. In 1964, they finally published the Declaration of Helsinki, which contained 22 recommendations, and they said was a guide to every physician in biomedical research involving human subjects. It's been revised five times since 1964, most recently in 2000, which has been a very controversial revision, mostly because of its implications for international research. In the United States, one of the most important events happens in the 1960s. This gentleman, Henry Beecher, who was professor of anesthesiological research at the Mass General Hospital and Harvard Medical School, published a famous paper in the New England Journal in which he delineated 22 examples in which he said patients never had the risk satisfactorily explained to them, and it seems obvious that further hundreds have not known that they were the subjects of an experiment, although grave consequences have been suffered. And he emphasizes in that article, which is summarized on your CD and in the book, that these were research studies not done at second-rate or peripheral institutions, but at the premier research institutions in the country, the NIH, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, the U.S. military, and that these were not rogue researchers. These were the cream of American clinical research. His 22 examples included withholding antibiotics from men with rheumatic fever, knowing that if they got rheumatic heart disease, they would die, and two of the men did die. Army soldiers died on that experiment. Injecting live cancer cells into nursing home patients, the so-called Jewish chronic disease hospital case done by researchers from Memorial Sloan Kettering, transplanting a melanoma from a daughter to a mother who died about a year and a half later of the melanoma. Given his prestige, this article carried a lot of weight, although for those of you who are in the audience, you ought to know one journal rejected it before the New England Journal accepted it. I'm going to just briefly talk about Tuskegee. You're going to get more of that from Susan Lederer next. It's a study that began in 1932 in Macon County, Alabama, with poor black sharecroppers, 400 who had syphilis and 200 who were uninfected controls. The United States Public Health Service actively, during the course of the trial, prevented the men from receiving penicillin and other therapies. As late as 1969, the CDC, which was overseeing the trial, had reviewed it and decided to continue the study. In 1972, a report by the Associated Press caused the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare to stop the study. By that time, 74 participants were still alive of the original, and about 100 subjects had been estimated to die from syphilis. It wasn't until 1996 that President Clinton actually apologized to the black community for the study. Tuskegee is important because it led to national outrage and the establishment of the National Commission, which issued many reports about research ethics, but most prominently probably the Belmont Report in 1979, which defined three key ethical principles for research: respect for persons, beneficence, and justice. It also directly led to the institutionalization of IRB review prior to research studies. There had been IRBs prior, including IRBs established at this place, the NIH, but this led to the institutionalization and requirement for it. That's a sort of whirlwind history that most historians would cringe at. But the research ethics guidelines, the regulations we have, are a direct result of that history, especially the last two parts of that history. I want to suggest to you, if none of the bad parts of those history happens, if we never had Nuremberg, if we never had Tuskegee, if Beecher's article, the material for it, never existed, we would still need clinical research guidelines. We would still need ethical rules. And the reason is that clinical research develops generalizable knowledge that improves health and increases our understanding. The people who participate in clinical research are a means to securing that generalizable knowledge. As a means, these people can be exploited. That is, they can take on risks and be used for the benefit of other people. Therefore, the ethical requirements for clinical research are in place to minimize the possibility of exploitation. So my point is that exploitation is inherent in all clinical research. Every study you do has the possibility of exploitation, and the purpose of the ethical guidelines we have is to minimize exploitation. That's why we have those rules. That's why if we never had an abuse or a scandal, we would still need ethical guidelines, because every time we start a research study, we risk exploiting the people who are enrolled. Now, when I came here, I read all of these guidelines, and I didn't think that they were adequate, and they didn't seem to me to provide a framework. Almost all these guidelines are a result of scandal. They're a response to a problem. As one of our colleagues, a bioethicist up in New York, said, that they were all born in scandal: Nuremberg, Belmont, certainly all born out of problems. They respond to the controversy at hand and do not provide a systematic, comprehensive framework stepping back. And frequently, if you read them, they're incomplete. And the guidelines also contradict each other. If you carefully read Nuremberg, it doesn't permit, for example, research on kids. Some guidelines don't talk about conflicts of interest. So we thought we needed a more systematic guideline that didn't respond to the latest controversy. We developed 8 principles: collaborative partnership, social value, scientific validity, fair subject selection, favorable risk-benefit ratio, independent review, informed consent, and respect for human subjects. Now, these are not randomly put up there in any higgledy-piggledy order. They are sequenced from the top to the bottom in the sequence that research development actually occurs. You don't get to informed consent until you've actually written a protocol and thought through the risk-benefit ratio or the subject selection. You don't get there until you thought about what is the purpose of this research. How are we going to ensure the data are valid? Let me go over each one. To be ethical, clinical research must involve the community in which it occurs. This requires community participation in planning, conducting, and overseeing research, and integrating research results into the health system. It also means avoiding supplanting existing healthcare services and sharing the rewards with the community. Now, we initially didn't have this principle because, working in the United States, much of this is already in place and it's sort of in the background. You don't consciously think about it. And it didn't occur to us until we went to developing countries that didn't have 40, 50, 60 years of a clinical research infrastructure developed and lots of these in place. There are lots of easy mechanisms by which this principle is fulfilled. Community advisory boards. We have a community advisory board here at the NIH. We have a lot of community members on IRBs. No one would dream of initiating a big AIDS study or a breast cancer study or a study in diabetes without involving the patient communities. We have a lot of advocates that campaign with Congress to fund certain kinds of research. So there are lots of mechanisms for collaborative participation and partnership already in place. But this is something that needs to be thought of. Second, social value. To be ethical, clinical research must lead to improvements in health or advancements in generalizable knowledge that will then lead to improvements in health through further research. You have to consider how the research will improve the health of the participants in the research study, the community in which the research is being conducted, from which the participants are drawn, and then everyone else in the world. There are different people who can benefit from this. This also means that there's valueless research. It includes studies that can't be generalized, studies that are me-too studies. I'm not talking about the second or third or fourth study in a very controversial area, but I'm talking about the study that's showing something that's well-established. Non-disseminated results. If you have research results that are in the bottom drawer that you've never presented or never published, it's hard for the world to benefit from those data. Third principle, scientific validity. Research must be conducted in a methodologically rigorous manner that is practically feasible. To be ethical, the research must produce reliable and valid data that can be interpreted. Now, a lot of people talk about, you know, the conflict between science and ethics. I think that is a false conflict. If you don't have good science that produces reliable data, you don't have an ethical study. You have a research study that produces data which you can't interpret. It is unethical. You have put people at risk for data that's not worth anything. Invalid research includes underpowered studies, because you can't actually get to an endpoint, studies with biased endpoints, biased instruments, biased statistical tests, and studies that cannot enroll sufficient subjects at the start. So, for example, if you test your drug against an inadequate dosage of another drug, that is a biased study. That is not scientifically valid. That is not an ethical research study. If you include an endpoint that is too soon to be valid, that is not a scientifically valid study. Fourth principle, fair subject selection. The scientific objectives of the study, not vulnerability, not privilege, should guide inclusion criteria and target population. Now, scientific objectives is not necessarily going to limit the people who you can enroll or approach, right? If you're doing a study on malaria, there are probably 100 countries in the world where you could do that study. So in addition to scientific objectives, you have to look at lowering risk, enhancing generalizability, but only after you've considered the scientific objectives of the study. Convenient groups should not be selected just because they're convenient. You don't go to an orphanage just because it's easy, but you can go to an orphanage if there's a reason that's a good place to do the study. Groups cannot be excluded without good scientific reasons. You don't just exclude women because you don't like that extra X chromosome. Higher risk is a good reason to exclude certain groups, right? You want to reduce the risk. So you shouldn't also select the politically powerful or otherwise well-connected for promising research studies. And I have here the endostatin example. 8 years ago, May 1999, there was an article in the Sunday New York Times above the fold. Any of you who know anything, that is like prime real estate in the media market. Above the fold on page one of the New York Times on a Sunday. You don't get better than that. Gina Collada had an article about endostatin. And the whole start of the article is how this was the most amazing drug. She had Jim Watson quoted in there saying that the discoverer was going to win the Nobel Prize. She talked about how it had cured cancers in mice. Research study on the phase one, it had never been put into humans, on the phase one was to start the next Monday, the next day, at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston and MD Anderson in Houston. I can assure you that the phones at that places, those two places, rang off the hook. People were trying to get onto the study. People who were well-connected were calling trustees they knew. People who knew the president were calling the president to get onto the study. Both institutions had to develop very detailed mechanisms of how to ensure that they were not going to simply enroll people who were well-connected to the powers that be. So it's not just going and targeting poor people or targeting people who are vulnerable or convenient. Sometimes the politically well-connected want to be on research also. And fairness requires attending not to the rich and attending not to the poor, but focusing on the science, the risk, the generalizability of your data. Fifth, favorable risk-benefit ratio. Clinical research must be conducted in a manner consistent with the standards of clinical practice, and you need to make sure that your risk-benefit ratio is fair. I think this is the most important, least understood principle, and least attended to. I, from my experience, think there's a four-step evaluation. The first thing you do is identify the risks, assess them, and minimize them. You have to include all risks. Physical risks, we're pretty good at this. Death, disability, infection. Psychological risks, sometimes, especially in genetic studies, we attend to this, depression, anxiety. Social risk, discrimination. Economic risk, job loss. Now, it's important that when you assess risks in each of these categories, you don't begin inventing things. Oh, well, I think people are going to be discriminated against. You need to think through and assess them rigorously. You evaluate both the likelihood of the risk, what are the chances it's going to happen. You also evaluate the magnitude of harm that could happen. And you identify mechanisms to minimize those risks. Are additional diagnostic tests good at excluding people who are at high risk? If you do the study first in the hospital, is that going to minimize chances of serious problems or if serious problems develop, minimize their magnitude? Second, you do the same for potential benefits to the individual research participants. You consider the physical, the psychological, social, and economic benefits to the individual. But you consider only the benefits from research interventions, not the benefits from added health services like that hepatitis B vaccine you happened to slip in that had nothing to do with the research trial, or payments that aren't necessary to complete the research goals. One of the problems is you can always inflate the added stuff that has nothing to do with the research to outweigh risks. The third point is then you compare the potential benefits to the individual with the potential risks to the individual. If the benefits exceed the risks, you're home free on this. But if the risks outweigh the benefits to the particular individual, then you have an issue. Then you need the social benefits of the research. How much knowledge are they going to improve? How pivotal is this knowledge to society to balance out those risks? This is a much more complicated evaluation, and let me just say we don't have a good algorithm or formula for this. Because investigators have multiple legitimate interests, they have potential conflicts of interest. They have interest in completing the study fast. They have interest in publishing it in a good journal. They have interest in getting their research funded again. It's because of these potential conflicts of interest that independent review of the research is necessary to minimize these conflicts. Independent review does a second thing. It assures the public out there that the research results are not gained at the cost of exploitation. The public is not going to benefit by the abuse of subjects. Seventh, informed consent. Informed consent ensures individuals decide whether they enroll in research and whether the research fits with their own values, interests, and goals. For those who can't consent, such as children or the mentally impaired, we have to be sure the research fits with their interests. We're going to have a whole section on informed consent, but in general, informed consent, it considers four elements. Some people reduce it to three, some people expand it to five. I think four is a nice, happy medium. Competence of the subject. You need a mentally competent subject to give informed consent. Disclosure of information to the subject. Understanding or comprehension of that information by the subject for their circumstance. And voluntariness in consenting. The federal regulations require these eight elements be included in each informed consent form: the purpose and duration of the participation, the risks, the benefits, the alternatives, confidentiality of records, compensation for injuries, if any, typically there aren't any, person to contact for answers to questions, and voluntariness and the right to withdraw. I'm not sure why these eight were selected personally. I'm not sure these would be my top list, but those are what the regulations say, and we're going to discuss that at a whole section later. Now, when I was training, we thought that once you got the informed consent document, that was it. The ethics were done. Wrong. That signature of the patient on the document, that is not the end. The ethical requirements don't end there. There are at least five additional things you need to do. You tell the patient you're going to protect their confidentiality. Guess what? You actually have to do it. If they want to withdraw, you have to permit them to withdraw. That doesn't mean they say, I want to withdraw. You just roll over. You can try to find out what their concern is. You can try to persuade them. But if they insist, you have to let them withdraw. If new information is developed about risks or benefits, you need to provide them new information in the course of the trial. Probably most important, you need to monitor their welfare and protect their welfare in case something untoward goes wrong. And you need to inform them of what was learned from the research. This last one is one we are all bad at, and I'm probably the leading violator of this. One of the things we learn from the patient panel every year is, I participated in that research at the NIH. Everything was fantastic. The nurses were great. The doctors had all the time in the world. I was cared for. I had very well informed about the trial. But I don't know what happened, and it really bothers me. We are very bad about communicating this. We think that when we publish our results in the New England Journal of Medicine or the Proceedings of the National Academy, that is enough. But the participants want to know what happened. What was learned? What changed? Because I helped. All eight requirements are necessary and essential to make clinical research ethical. You can't say, I like 1, 2, 4, and 8, but you know that 7, not for me. It's all 8. Now, independent review and informed consent are procedural requirements, and they ensure the other values are achieved. There are different ways you can get those. So, for example, a child can't give informed consent. There are other ways to fulfill that requirement. Now, we should be honest, too, that fulfilling all 8 requirements can create conflicts. What's fair in subject selection may increase risks. What enhances scientific validity could increase risks. What's necessary to respect people who are enrolled might threaten scientific validity if too many people withdraw. Conflicts are going to happen. There's no simple formula. This is not mathematics or calculus. We have to adjust the design to meet the requirements. Some people talk about balancing or weighing or specifying principles. I think the important point is to be clear why you've selected or gone for one principle over another and to explain your reasons. This also has an important implication that different ways of approaching the same trial might be ethical. There may not be one unique, only ethical manner to do a research trial. People might balance different considerations differently. Now, to evaluate a research trial, we need a lot of different expertise. Educated, trained investigators, IRBs with investigator statisticians, ethicists, lay people. I also think all 8 requirements are universal. They don't only apply to Europe and the United States, developed countries. They apply to clinical research everywhere. On the other hand, the 8 ethical requirements must be adapted to the local culture, local circumstances, technological abilities, the risk-benefit ratio. It's going to be a lot different if you're testing an anti-infectious agent here in the United States where the infection is very rare versus Africa where it might kill 2,000 people a year. Very, very different risk-benefit profile. These are the 8 requirements: collaborative partnership, social value, scientific validity, fair subject selection, favorable risk-benefit ratio, independent review, informed consent, and respecting human subjects. And remember, they're in an order for a reason, from the conception of research down to its implementation. Let's go back to BY and the case at the start. Is it ethical to enroll a mentally incompetent patient in a phase 3 randomized chemo prevention trial? Well, after I thought through this framework, I thought I knew the answer to this question. But just to be sure, I work with a lot of really smart people at the Department of Bioethics. And so I emailed the case to people and said, what do you think the right answer is? And amazingly, I got 3 different answers. The first one of my colleagues, who I think is very, very smart and sensitive, said, BY can't consent. There are many eligible participants. As a matter of fact, in this trial, many, many women who were health professionals, nurses or doctors or physical therapists or pharmacists, enrolled themselves. She therefore isn't necessary to the trial. Enroll other patients who can consent and give her usual care. Another colleague stressed the risk-benefit ratio and the social value and said, informed consent is not an absolute requirement. We do enroll people who can't consent. The risk-benefit ratio of the study is positive. She's getting at least as good care in this research study as clinical care. And then add to that, she's contributing to the knowledge of society as to which treatment is better. As long as mentally disabled patients are not only targeted for this trial, it's fine to enroll BY. Third person said, stressed fair subject selection and said, look, to deny BY access to the trial would be unjust. She meets all the eligibility criteria, has a similar risk-benefit profile as any person who could consent. The only reason to exclude her has nothing to do with the science of the research study. So to exclude her would be discrimination and would be unfair. You have to give her the option of enrolling. Thank you very much.
We've got 5 minutes, I've been told. 5 minutes for questions.
Are the slides on the CD?
No,
but they will be on the
website. Yeah. They all versions of this talk, there are probably 25 on the website, I think.
I think they new ones will be put on.
But there's a video of it, too. Yeah.
So was BY enrolled or not?
Was BY enrolled or not? I refuse to answer that question on the grounds that it might incriminate me. Yeah, there were 3 of us who sat in a room and fought it out. Well, for one thing, it took about 3 years to finally parse everything down and to distill it. And we originally came up with 7, if you actually look at the CD and look at the papers. We originally came up with 7. And then, as I mentioned, because of our experience in developing countries, realized that there was an 8th that we were not seeing because of the sort of heavily developed infrastructure and background in the United States about the importance of working with the community and making sure that the research actually fit in with the community priorities, and that led to the collaborative partnership. But that they were developed here is irrelevant to whether they're true or not. Their truth, the importance of them, is irrelevant to the fact that it happened to be at the NIH. I will just say, not that I want to toot the horn of the department too much, but I will say that they have been incorporated into the regulations in at least 3 countries, Nigeria, Kenya, and Sri Lanka, but also many IRBs in this country have used them, developed them into a checklist for reviewing protocols. That doesn't make them true. Whether they're true or not depends upon whether they, in fact, fulfilling them actually makes research ethical. That's the real question. Is that it? board the rest of you? Yeah.
So the eight requirements you listed, are each associated with a different stage of the research? Have you given thought to which of those are more important?
You've got to fulfill all eight. It's not a as I said before, it's not a matter of 1, 2, 7, and 8. You've got to fulfill all eight. We believe that it does go along with the sequence of developing research. You don't think, I'm going to think about research and jump into, well, what will the informed consent look like? You have to think at the start, why am I doing this research? What's the value of the research going to be? How can I ensure that the research data is valid? I have my own views on which are more important, but I can assure you that they're far from widely shared by everyone else. As I think I mentioned, whether it's the most important or not, I think underdeveloped and underthought through is the one of the risk-benefit ratio. I gave you sort of Zeke Emanuel's armchair view of how to think about risk-benefit ratio and how to go through it, but I think that's a principle that needs a lot more work. If you compare the amount of research and thinking about, for example, informed consent with risk-benefit ratio, the papers look like this. So, yeah. Well, first, good question. How do the principles apply to community physicians who are doing research in relation to pharma but aren't necessarily an academic institution? I take that. Well, first of all, research protocol has to go through an IRB before it even gets to the community physicians, and I take it that the IRB is going to use some framework to evaluate the ethics of the research and to certify that, in their view, the research is ethical and fulfills either these requirements or whatever principles they use. I mean, we think they ought to fulfill this if, in fact, the IRB says it's ethical. So the community physicians ought not to be seeing a protocol that hasn't fulfilled these requirements. Now, they, I hope, have their own process of trying to evaluate the ethics of a trial that they would participate in. And, you know, they can use this. There are alternative ways of thinking about it, presumably they think they don't just jump onto any trial that passes through the transom there. So there are at least two mechanisms. One is the IRB process. Any protocol that a community physician sees has to have passed an IRB. And second of all, the researchers themselves have to think through whether this is ethical and something they want to participate in.
Yes, so is a highly flawed hypothesis made in good faith?
How would it be highly flawed and made in good faith? If it's highly flawed, I mean, your intention is not very relevant to, you know, if you're a good person, you know, if you fulfill the Ten Commandments, that doesn't mean you're an ethical researcher. Well, if you think it's going to answer the question, but an independent group called the IRB looks at it and says, well, you know, this is flawed research, it really won't give you scientifically valid data, I mean, that's one of the reasons, as I mentioned, we have independent review. Because we all have biases, right? I have a bias. This has got to be right. I'm going to design this trial this way. One of the reasons we have an independent review process is because we're not always necessarily the most objective observers of our own work. Right. Oh, yeah. Good point. Maybe that's what you were pointing at. Negative results, right? I had a hypothesis the study showed wrong, doesn't make the research unethical. That would be crazy, right? In phase three randomized trials, if they're designed with equipoise in mind, right, we don't know which is better, the tamoxifen or the raloxifene, right? A negative result to our hypothesis, right, doesn't make the trial unethical. The whole point of a trial is we don't know which is better and we're going to find out. Does that answer the question? I didn't know whether it was A or B. Yeah.
Oh.
I can answer that question definitively. The answer is no. My own view is that's a really big problem, that you can give the same protocol to two different IRBs, and you can get wildly different evaluations. Now, it may be that one IRB is identified a particular problem, and another IRB identified another problem. Both are problems. Or it may be that they've just come to very, very different evaluations for reasons that are really unrelated to the research trial. In general, we don't know much about IRB evaluation. What we do know is that it is highly variable among IRBs. Whether that variability is really related to ethical problems with protocols or ethical problems with IRBs, it still needs to be determined. The problem of multiple reviews of a single protocol because of multi-site studies and getting very different reviews that aren't really necessarily all that important and don't necessarily protect research participants, I think is a major problem with the IRB system now. But that goes beyond these points and may reflect the fact that not every review is being done in a systematic, coherent, thoughtful, comprehensive, definitive manner. All right, last question. Yeah. Yeah, I had a slide up there. Are we should these apply to international clinical trials? I had a slide up there that said that the rules, that these eight principles don't just apply in developed countries. I believe they apply everywhere, that they need to be adapted to local circumstances. So to give you another example, we are obsessed by signatures on papers. We think that only by a signature do you confirm that you consent. There are obviously many other ways of consenting. If you go to other countries, sharing a meal is a consent. Hugging each other is a consent. The Amish in this country don't sign papers. They consent by shaking the hand. So there are lots of ways, for example, to indicate you consent. That we are obsessed by a signature is a cultural product, not something that is inherently ethical. So you might adapt the consent process to the local cultural circumstances. That's an example of where you would have the principle, everyone's got to voluntarily consent, but you would adapt what signifies consent to the local cultural process. Okay? So, you're going to introduce the next speaker.
Thank you. I just want to make two comments before I introduce the next speaker. Some of your questions, which were very important, will be answered over the course of the next several weeks. If you look at the syllabus, we will spend a whole session on risk and benefits. We will spend a section on fair subject selection, on IRBs, on the rules that IRBs follow, those kinds of things. So you'll get more of this kind of information over the next several classes. The other thing I wanted to say is that, well, I gave you a pass for the first session. From now on, if you could, when you have a question, could you come to the microphone? Because we have people watching, as Zeke said, from various places that are not in this room, and it would be nice for them to hear the questions as well. So with that, I'm going to introduce our next speaker. We are very privileged to have with us today Dr. Susan Lederer, who is an associate professor in the Department of the History of Medicine at the Yale University School of Medicine. And she's going to talk to us about some of the history of clinical research, especially the scandals and tragedies, some of which you've probably heard about before and some of which Zeke alluded to already. So, Susan?
Good morning. You heard Zeke Emanuel say historians would probably cringe. As a historian, I can tell you we're just grateful that the history gets in there, particularly in this realm, because the history, I think, is so essential to understanding the kind of regulatory apparatus that we have today that governs the conduct of human experimentation. And some of this I'll be revisiting in what I'll consider to be my scandalously short history of human experimentation, some of which you just heard from Dr. Emanuel. He mentioned James Lind and his therapeutic experiment on shipboard, dividing the semen into six groups, giving elixir vitriol, vinegar, seawater, cider, the bigness of the nutmeg, but most importantly, the two oranges and the lemon. He also mentioned the introduction of smallpox variolation in 1721. It was championed by Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, again, sort of directly using smallpox pus from one person to another with the idea of preventing a more severe case of smallpox. Before it was tested on the royal children, that is the princesses, they actually arranged for six inmates from Newgate Prison who agreed in response for a parole to undergo variolation and then to be challenged with exposure to someone with active smallpox. Another great development in the history of smallpox, of course, was the introduction of vaccination, which was late in the 18th century, associated with the English physician Edward Jenner, and the discovery that cowpox would actually confer protection from the more dangerous smallpox. This introduction of vaccination, who was the first recipient, is James Phipps, an eight-year-old boy who's the son of Jenner's gardener, who then, after he receives the vaccination, is again challenged by exposure to someone with active disease. Now, fortunately, Phipps did very well, and Jenner, quote, never forgot the service this child rendered to science and actually provided a home for Phipps, complete with a rose garden, which is today the site of the Jenner Museum in England. In the United States, sort of physicians welcomed a means to control the deadly scourge of smallpox. Benjamin Waterhouse, a Boston physician, sometimes called the Jenner of America, tries to provide a definitive experiment in which he takes orphans at the Noddle's Island Asylum, injects smallpox into 19 children who have been vaccinated, but also injects smallpox pus or into two unvaccinated children, and is able to conclude that this decisive experiment, in which only the unvaccinated develop smallpox, has fixed forever the practice of the new inoculation in Massachusetts. And if you think about some of the great discoveries and research conducted in the 19th century, many of which involved studies of human experimentation. Perhaps this experiment is familiar to you, the Army physician William Beaumont, who was able to work with Alexis St. Martin, a Canadian voyageur, who had the misfortune to be shot at close range with a musket and whose gastric fistula Beaumont was never able to close, but this was an unparalleled opportunity to study the processes of digestion in the human subject. But how do you get your subject to agree to undergo the rigors of experimentation? These involve, for example, was interested in what foodstuffs would digest more readily. So they would take like a piece of chicken, put it on a string, put it into the stomach, take it out, and compare. Did chicken digest more readily than lamb, than mutton, than beef, and so on? But one of the things that William Beaumont found necessary to do was to actually enter into a contractual arrangement with his subject, which included a payment of about $150. He had a lawyer draw up a contractual arrangement. I'm not going to read you the whole thing, but you can see the kind of legal phraseology. To submit to, assist, and promote by all means in his power such physiological and medical experiments as the said William shall direct or cause to be made on or the stomach of him, the said Alexis, either through or by the means of the aperture or opening thereto in the side of him. I mean, it goes on. The said Alexis will obey, suffer, and comply with all reasonable and proper orders or experiments of the said William in relation thereto in relation of exhibiting and showing his said stomach and the powers and properties thereof. And it goes on. They had a difficult relationship, these two individuals. And Beaumont often bemoaned the fact that St. Martin was not as cooperative with him. Despite this agreement. Now, one of the perhaps most notorious experiments in the 19th century involved the work of obstetrician gynecologist James Marion Sims, who for many decades was revered as the father of American gynecology, and who was praised for, among other things, developing a successful operative procedure to repair vesicovaginal fistula, which was a serious injury that many women suffered during childhood. Since the 19th century, and increasingly sort of in the last couple of decades, what was once seen as a great moment in medicine, that is his ability to perfect this procedure, has been called into question because the people he was able to use were enslaved women whose names we know because he recorded them in his autobiography. Lucy, Betsy, and Anarka underwent as many as 30 procedures without ether or chloroform in order for him to perfect this procedure, which when he moved to New York was extended to white women who at the time were believed were unable to sustain sort of the level of pain that African-American women could endure. Think, too, of sort of the great French chemist, Louis Pasteur, and sort of the important announcement, sort of discovery, development of a vaccine for rabies, and his successful demonstration of the vaccine on a young boy, age 10, who had been bitten by a rabid dog. And then it turns out, however, on close inspection of his laboratory notebooks, that his public claims about the demonstrated safety and efficacy of his vaccine were not, in fact, true, that he, in fact, had not made the experiments on animals that he claimed to have made, and that he was very fortunate that Joseph Meister, in fact, survived that initial human use of this rabies vaccine. Now, one of the things that I would like to emphasize to you is that there was concern in the United States between sort of the decades of 1890 and 1920, criticism and public discussion over the use of human beings in research, criticism about what was called human vivisection, which is essentially human experimentation. And these critics are perhaps not the people one might ordinarily suspect. Among the most vociferous critics were the animal protectionists. Those people who were concerned about the safety and welfare of animals in research were the ones calling attention to the exploitation of children and orphans and the insane in medical research. Also, physicians were among those who criticized the conduct of some experiments involving human subjects, and finally, some members of the lay public. One of the things that the animal protectionists did was to point to a tremendous increase in the numbers of human experiments in line with the germ theory of disease that had been championed by Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch in England, and in particular, sort of with the need to conform to the third of Robert Koch's postulates that in order that you have to demonstrate that a particular bacterium is in fact the cause of the disease. So it's not enough to isolate and culture it. You have to inject it into the person in order to show that it causes the disease in question. So they pointed to, among other things, such experiments as this conducted by George Fitch, in which he inoculated 6 leprous girls with what he called the virus of syphilis in order to demonstrate that syphilis and leprosy were, in fact, manifestations of the same disease. Now, again, a wrong-headed experiment, it turns out syphilis and leprosy are, in fact, quite different diseases. They also pointed to studies which come from the published medical literature about New York pediatrician Henry Hyman's report of how to demonstrate that gonococcus causes gonorrhea. He infected 3 people. But again, what they would call attention to were the status of those individuals. An idiot with chronic epilepsy, 4 years old. Another idiot, 16-year-old. And then a 26-year-old man in the final stages of tuberculosis. They were also quite critical of tuberculin testing. Tuberculin had been introduced by Robert Koch in 1891 as a cure for tuberculosis, and people from around the world flooded into Berlin. Now, it turns out it wasn't a cure, but it was a very useful diagnostic test for tuberculosis. And so pointing to, well, what kinds of experimental material can be used to demonstrate the efficacy of a test involving tuberculin? And so there's discussion about material, in quotations, from such orphans and destitute children as the St. Vincent's Home in Philadelphia. And so, one of the issues is, well, what's the best way, to instill tuberculin? Do you want to do it in deep muscle? Do you want to do it in the skin? Do you want to do it into the eye? Well, the eye test required applying tuberculin to the surface of the eye, but as the physicians reported in the literature, it produced a decidedly uncomfortable lesion, serious inflammations of the eye, and some children, in fact, suffered permanent eye damage. Children like this, Kitty Logan, who was profiled in William Randolph Hearst magazine, Cosmopolitan, in 1910. Now, there was also medical criticism at the time of the conduct of some experiments involving human subjects, and in particular, children. And I'll point to sort of this lumbar puncture testing in particular. A pediatrician, Arthur Howard Wentworth at Harvard Medical School, in 1895, publishes a report in which he describes control experiments on normal cases of lumbar puncture. He wants to show that it's a safe procedure overall. And so what he does is to withdraw spinal fluid from some 29 children ranging in age from a few months to a few years. There's no mention of parental consent. Some of these children are, in fact, very close to dying. And in his article, he explicitly notes that the momentary pain of the puncture caused the children to shrink back and cry out. But he concludes that essentially the procedure is safe and harmless, and it would be a useful diagnostic tool, and that you wouldn't have to wait until children were moribund before resorting to it. Well, physicians in Philadelphia greeted the publication of this report with great criticism, labeling it human vivisection, and this from a physician writing in 1896, "It must be remembered that there were no therapeutic indications for the operation, such as often lead us to justly and properly adopt operative treatment, the positive value of which is still undetermined. These experiments were purely and avowedly experimental." Now, but Arthur Wentworth is going on saying, "I consider myself justified in incurring some risk." And that's why he went. We've already heard about William Osler, and I'll come back to him in just a minute. Animal protectionists and members of the public were also critical of some of the experiments then in vogue to demonstrate that deficiencies in diet were responsible in certain diseases. The disease of pellagra, which we now know to be caused by a deficiency of niacin, which was a major killer of people in Mississippi and in Alabama, the disease of the 4Ds, dermatitis, diarrhea, dementia, and death. The dietary hypothesis was one that was being championed by Joseph Goldberger of the Public Health Service. He did a demonstration at orphanages showing that a diet of fresh meat, milk, and vegetables, that children recovered from pellagra. Here's Joseph Goldberger. One of the things that Goldberger had to do was to overcome the idea that pellagra was caused by a germ. So he actually participated, along with his wife and his colleagues, in a series of what can only be described as disgusting experiments, in which they would ingest excretions, various bodily excretions of patients with pellagra, would also be injected with blood from pellagra's patients and other bodily excretions to show that pellagra was not transmitted by a germ. But the definitive demonstration comes when he receives permission from the governor of Mississippi to conduct an experiment at the Rankin Prison Farm, in which 12 men out of some 50 who agree to participate in return for a parole are placed on a diet of meat, meal, cornmeal, and molasses until they develop the characteristic lesions of pellagra. Now, animal protectionists at the time point to, they're the only ones, by the way, they point to the inability of prisoners in such a situation to exercise voluntary consent because of their lack of freedom. However, citizens of Mississippi had different concerns. They were very critical that, in fact, at the men who had been chosen to participate, convicted rapists, murderers, and embezzlers, these were people who should not be paroled under any circumstances, their willingness to participate in such a dangerous experiment or not. There's also criticism at the time of some of the experiments to establish the etiology of the of dietary diseases of rickets and scurvy. Among the most controversial was one conducted by the pediatrician Alfred Fabian Hess, who was the medical director of the Hebrew Orphan Asylum in New York City. Had very abiding interest in sort of the etiology of these two diseases, which greatly afflicted many Americans at the time. And he conducted an experiment in which he withheld orange juice from children and infants until they developed the lesions of infantile scurvy. Once the lesions healed, orange juice was again withheld from the children, and then he made similar efforts to create a diet to induce rickets, again with the idea of establishing the etiology and a means to prevent the disease. And these experiments were publicly criticized in several publications, this one from 1921. No devotion to science, no thought of the greater good to the greater number can for an instant justify the experimenting on helpless infants, children pathetically abandoned by fate and entrusted to the community for their safeguarding. Voluntary consent by adults should, of course, be the sine qua non of scientific experimentation. Now, interestingly, physicians at the time defended Hess, and in an editorial, for example, in a medical journal in 1921, American Medicine, the editor argued that well-conducted experiments on infants actually provided an opportunity for these children who were housed at the expense of others, who were receiving, you know, social welfare, to, quote, make a large return to the community for the care devoted to them. So a defense of the utility of safe studies conducted on this population. Now, there were efforts, even in this early period, at external regulation of medical research. And in fact, in 1900, the United States Congress considered Senate Bill 3424, which would have required all investigators to disclose in advance to participants the purpose and procedures of any non-therapeutic experiment involving human beings. It would expressly ban experiments on those deemed unable to consent, including infants, children under the age of 21, and pregnant women. This bill was not passed. Now, so there are efforts at external regulation, but there are also internal constraints. And you've heard Dr. Emanuel already signal sort of Walter Reed and the yellow fever experiments as a means to ensure the safety of participants, to ensure that they're aware of their participation, and also to indemnify them against public criticism. This is sort of a painting of Walter Reed, the yellow fever experiments. The introduction of a written consent form, and one of the things I'll note is that since many of the people recruited into this study were Spanish volunteers newly arrived to Cuba who it was assumed had not been exposed to yellow fever, the forms were actually available in both English and Spanish. They actually used the Spanish age of consent, which was 25, and no men under the age of 25 were recruited into the study. And again, some of the phraseology, the undersign understands perfectly well that in the development of yellow fever in humans, that he endangers his life to a certain extent, but it being entirely impossible for him to avoid the infection during his stay on the island, he prefers to take the chance of contracting it intentionally in the belief that he will receive from the said commission the greatest care and the most skillful medical service. I think I'll skip this now, but this is, again, sort of referring to the fact that the Spanish volunteers were not averse to being bitten by mosquitoes because they anticipated being bitten by mosquitoes in Cuba, that they were going to be paid $100 in gold and another equal sum as a result of the biting experiment. But he goes on to say, needless to say, no reference was made to any possible funeral expenses. But a written consent was obtained so that our moral responsibility was to a certain extent lessened. And they only chose the healthiest specimens to undergo being exposed to the deadly disease of yellow fever. I want to suggest that in this first part of the 20th century, there were also sort of informal efforts to point out deficiencies in the conduct of human experimentation. I had the opportunity to look at the editorial correspondence of the Journal of Experimental Medicine, which was the leading journal of medical research in the first half of the 20th century, and where the editor of that journal, Francis Peyton Rouse, was very sensitive to the use of both animal subjects and human subjects. And for example, in 1941, Rouse received a manuscript from a physician from San Diego, William Black, who described how he had injected a 12-month-old white female volunteer with herpes virus. Now, Rouse rejected that manuscript for publication, but he also took the opportunity to write you know, sort of his views about the morality of such a an experiment. I cannot let this occasion pass without saying that in my personal view, the inoculation of a 12-month-old infant with herpes virus obtained from an adult was an abuse of power, an infringement on the rights of the individual, and not excusable because the illness that followed had implications for science. The statement that the child was offered as a volunteer, whatever that may mean, does not palliate the action. So it was rejected from the Journal of Experimental Medicine. However, I did look in other pediatric journals, and in fact it was published in the Journal of Pediatrics in 1942, and it does include sort of the reference to infection of with herpes virus of a 12-month-old volunteer, so that these informal mechanisms were not always effective in regulating sort of on an internal basis the conduct of human experimentation. Now, World War II, there was a massive increase in both funding and in personnel for research, and not just in the United States, but in countries actively involved in the war. You think of Germany, Japan, England, and so on. Much of the research that was conducted, and I'm going to focus on the U.S., was related to the war effort. And it's very interesting to me that much of the kinds of experiments that American researchers were interested was in fact similar to the research interests of, say, the Nazi experimenters or the Japanese, interested in the effects of hypothermia, in the effects of high altitude, interested in desalinization studies or the potability of seawater, in the care and treatment of burns and wounds, in blood substitutes, and vaccines and treatments for malaria, for such diseases as malaria, gonorrhea, and hepatitis. These images are from the Dachau concentration camp, where they conducted hypothermia studies that, with death as an endpoint in some cases, they were interested in studying rewarming techniques, particularly for aviators whose plane had been down, perhaps they'd been exposed to cold water in the North Sea. So studies of ways to effectively rewarm. Also from Dachau, studies of the effects of high altitude. Now again, sort of these effects of high altitude and hypothermia were studied in the United States, but with different methods, different endpoints, and including sort of self-experimentation by some of the investigators involved. Efforts to make seawater potable. You've already heard reference to the Nuremberg doctors' trial or United States versus Karl Brandt et al. That is a prosecution of 23 Nazi medical personnel, including Karl Brandt, who was a very high-ranking Nazi physician and Hitler's personal physician. Seven of the 23 were hanged after being found guilty. Some eight were exonerated, and the remaining number were sentenced, but many of these sentences were later commuted. And of course, one of the issues that confronted the judges at the Nuremberg Doctors' Tribunal was, well, what standards do we use to judge the conduct of such experimentation? You know, how are we going to deal with the rest of the German medical profession? And another question I won't actually get to, but one that has continued, is, you know, how do you deal with the Nazi data? In the context of the Tuskegee syphilis study, which I'll get to, sort of, well, what do you do with the data that was obtained under such manifestly unethical circumstances? Is there an appropriate way to deal with such data? Well, in order to judge the conduct of these Nazi physicians and medical administrators, the tribunal came up with what was called permissible medical experiments, which has since come to be known as the Nuremberg Code. And you already heard Dr. Emanuel refer to the first principle, which is the one most often quoted, and it's sort of the greatest in length, that the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. Would American investigators have met the Nuremberg Code? I think it's safe to say no, because during World War II, there were many experiments that were conducted on orphans, for example, with American orphans, with experimental malaria vaccines and so forth, in which children fortunately did not die, but encountered sort of very uncomfortable and dangerous situations. And there are other examples as well. I'm going to skip to, however, sort of the climate of post-war medical research, in which I would argue that, again, sort of the research enterprises sort of gains in both the numbers and dollars committed to clinical research involving humans. This is a time when there is enormous support from American society for American researchers. And I would argue there's a valorization, or there's a value put on those people who are willing to serve as volunteers. You'll see in popular magazines like Reader's Digest, "I was a human guinea pig," for example, or "prisoners, willing to undergo disease and death to help society." There is the creation of a Walter Reed Society for people who have served as a volunteer in medical research. You know, you pay dues of $1 each year. You have to have your application signed off on by a medical experimenter. And these volunteers are also celebrated. And the idea is that this is research that is conducted on people who are willing to help not only the war effort, but the continuing war on disease. Men like these conscientious objectors who were profiled in Life magazine in 1946, these were men who did not enter military service, but agreed to enter the Minnesota Starvation Study that was conducted at the University of Minnesota under the leadership of the physiologist Ansel Keys. They were interested studying the effects of semi-starvation, and again, what were the best ways to bring people back from the starved state in light of the conditions of starvation then operative in Europe in the wake of World War II. And this is also from Life magazine, showing one of the conscientious objectors whose heart rhythm is being studied after he's been on a diet that greatly reduces his caloric intake for a period of some 6 months. This is also, I think, some indirect evidence of the very different climate of medical research then operated. Sort of, there was great interest, not only in the United States, but elsewhere, in a blood substitute, something that could be, that you wouldn't have to worry about blood typing or getting the right blood. It could be readily available. Some of this research was conducted at the University of Washington, where in 1952, an 18-year-old college student died after an injection of the blood substitute that was contaminated with bacteria. But what I think is interesting is the attitude of this young man's father, who says, well, this was a terrible tragedy, but it's so important for us to continue the work on finding a blood substitute and advancing medical knowledge. Right? So just a very different climate of medical research. Now, I've talked about both sort of external support or criticism, and there's also, I would argue, important internal developments. And you've already heard mention of this man, Henry K. Beecher, a professor, the first professor of anesthesiology at Harvard Medical School, also important in sort of another realm of bioethical debate and discussion. He was a convener of the Harvard Ad Hoc Brain Death Committee in the 1960s in light of the heart transplants and determinations of death for harvesting organs for transplantation. And you've had an opportunity, I think it's on your reading list, to read sort of his bombshell article that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1966. Dr. Emanuel mentioned that this article had been submitted to another journal. I don't think he mentioned which journal it was. It was the Journal of the American Medical Association, which declined to publish it. Beecher also supplied not 22 examples, but 50 examples, but the editors at the New England Journal cut it down for reasons of size. So they chose these 22 examples of questionable research, and again with an emphasis that these were not fringe researchers, not people on the outskirts of medicine, but people from the mainstream at the leading institutions, including those of the federal government. He mentioned a few. I'll mention a few others that of the 22, thymectomy as part of a study on skin homographs, studying ureteral reflux in newborns who were catheterized and x-rays, study the effects of a new antibiotic on liver function using juvenile delinquents, some of whom went on to develop liver abnormalities and underwent liver biopsies unrelated to their medical care, but as part of the experiment. Another of these 22 examples was one of was the Willowbrook study, which was one of the most infamous and discussed studies in the 1960s and 1970s, conducted under the auspices of pediatric infectious disease researcher Saul Krugman. It involved children at the Willowbrook State School, which was a school or an institution on Staten Island for severely mentally retarded children. And the purpose of the study was an important one, to inquire about the natural history of hepatitis and to provide sort of important work to the development of a vaccine for this significant disease. Newly admitted children whose parents consented to their participation were given intramuscular injections of hepatitis. They were actually given hepatitis virus, or so-called milkshakes with hepatitis. Krugman continued to defend the study, but there were a sort of discussion and issues persisted about consent. He used a form of group consent, about coercion. This is at a time when there's very little tolerance for the mentally retarded, and this was one of the few institutions that would take children. It was already overcrowded. If parents consented to the study, the hepatitis study, they could get their child admitted to the institution where they would receive much better care if they developed hepatitis than if they just waited for normal entry into the institution. But there were also questions that were raised about study design, and including some of the decisions to withhold, for example, gamma globulin. Another of these infamous studies was the Jewish Chronic Disease Hospital study, which was funded by the U.S. Public Health Service and also the American Cancer Society, that involved the injection of live cancer cells into elderly patients without their consent. It was said by the investigators they didn't want to stir up unnecessary anxieties in the patients who had phobia and ignorance about cancer. And at the end of this, one of the physicians involved did lose his privileges to practice medicine for one year. But perhaps the study that had the most profound effect on American attitudes toward the conduct of human experimentation and to the ability of medical researchers to govern their own conduct was the study that was revealed on July 25, 1972. Now, you heard Dr. Emanuel refer to sort of prime real estate on the newspaper page. July 25, 1972, the CDC researchers felt they were fortunate that their story was beneath the fold. They didn't make the prime real estate, because it was on that day that Senator Thomas Eagleton, who was the running mate of presidential candidate George McGovern, it was revealed that he had received electroshock therapy for his depression. And this was the front page section. But below the fold came the news that the U.S. Public Health Service had conducted a study of the effects of untreated syphilis on a group of 400 African-American men and 200 control subjects who were also African-American men. This is one of the editorial cartoons that appeared, I think, in the Denver newspaper about the revelation. A no-treatment study conducted by the Public Health Service on this population in rural Alabama. And I won't go into detail, because I'm sure this audience is familiar with many aspects of the study. I will point out that although the investigators insisted that it was a study in nature, that they were studying the effects of an untreated disease, untreated because this was a population that was too poor to get treatment, that the investigators actually performed active deception by labeling some of the diagnostic procedures, like lumbar puncture, as a special free treatment. They also prevented some of the men who would have been called up for military service in World War II, who would then have received free treatment for their disease. They went to the they went to the the draft board, had them excused from military service, and therefore they were also excused from the treatment that they would have received from their disease. So just to remind you, some of the men initially underwent lumbar puncture, a decidedly diagnostic procedure, but one that was touted as a last chance for special free treatment in order to obtain spinal fluid for diagnosis. Now, I want to make one other point, though, about the lumbar puncture, and that I think it would be a mistake to see this population as one that's just being wholly exploited by the Public Health Service investigators. The men initially underwent lumbar puncture, and actually the investigators wanted them to undergo further lumbar punctures. However, the men refused to undergo any further lumbar punctures, and the investigators had to actually give up on that part of the experiment because they couldn't get this population to agree to undergo that procedure again. And sort of this, one of the things that's perhaps unique about this longest non-therapeutic study of untreated syphilis is the fact that the Public Health Service nurse, Eunice Rivers, was indispensable to the study because she served as a bridge between the investigators and these men living in the rural South. It was Nurse Rivers' job, for example, to approach the men and their families to offer the burial stipend in exchange for an autopsy after the death of the participant, so that there could be a comparison of the symptoms, the clinical manifestations of syphilis in life with the pathological findings after death. And much has been made of the fact that this wasn't a secret study, that it was openly discussed in the medical literature. There were some 13 publications in mainstream American medical journals between 1936 and 1974. But I'll call your attention to several things, one in which I think it's very interesting that it's in 1954 that for the first time in one of these publications that men in the study are referred to or identified explicitly as volunteers with social incentives. And this comes from an article that appeared in 1954 that's actually comparing the Tuskegee syphilis study in Alabama with the so-called Oslo study of retrospective untreated syphilis in a white population, sort of Norwegian patients. But I'll call your attention to the fact that the men are identified, again, as volunteers with social incentives, including the burial stipend, including rides in the government car on the day of inspection, including free vitamins, free examinations. Also part of the effort to sort of recognize and regularize the participation of the men in this study in the 1950s was a certificate that was signed by the Surgeon General that was awarded to each of the men in 1958. They received this certificate along with a dollar for each of their years of participation in the study. But again, sort of note the language, in grateful recognition of 25 years of active participation in the Tuskegee Medical Research Study. Now, you've already heard mention of the fact that that there were criticisms that were raised by field investigators of the Public Health Service, and that in response to some of these discussions, the CDC actually convenes a blue ribbon panel in 1969 to determine whether they should continue the study or not. And I think it's significant that the only physician, a man named Eugene Stollerman, who was the chair of medicine at the University of Tennessee, he was the only physician previously familiar with the study, and he was the only physician on the panel who argued that the study should end and that the men should receive treatment. But the CDC decided to continue the study. And, of course, in 1972, on July 25th, it came, it was circulated on the Associated Press, became nationally known. It received also a great deal of attention when Senator Ted Kennedy held hearings on the conduct of human experimentation, including testimony from some of the participants in the Tuskegee syphilis study, which led to legislation that was passed in 1974, the National Research Act. Perhaps the most important thing that the National Research Act did was to create a national commission to study the moral problems, moral and ethical problems posed by human experimentation, and also to the sponsorship of new federal regulations about IRBs, institutional review boards, and written informed consent of participants. Now, there certainly has been sort of one question about why, given the public outrage and the discussion about the Tuskegee syphilis study, did it take so long for a member of the federal government to apologize to the participants in the study? Because the apology actually came in May 1997. And there's a lot we could talk about there. But the point I want to make is that this apology actually followed the apology in 1995 that President Clinton offered to those Americans whose lives had been darkened by the shadow of the atom, that is, who had been recruited without their knowledge or consent into some of the 4,000 experiments involving ionizing radiation that had been conducted under the auspices of the federal government between 1944 and 1974. And this is showing the final report of the President's Advisory Commission on the Human Radiation Experiments. I think one of the things that's interesting to me about the history of human experimentation and about the discussions about the appropriate use of human subjects is how do we come to terms with the past? And, you know, it's more than just using data. How do we understand? How do we move forward to continue to protect human subjects? One of the ways that some people have found closure has been in terms of settlements, legal and financial settlements. And I will point out there was, in fact, a financial settlement that was reached with the participants of the Tuskegee syphilis study. It was an out-of-court settlement in 1974. But in the wake of the disclosure and discussion about the human radiation experiments, there were sort of much discussion of some of these settlements. For example, for the 18 individuals who received plutonium injections, the federal government settled out of court with the families of 16 of 18 participants. Relatives of 13 patients received approximately $400,000. Simeon Shaw was a 4-year-old Australian boy who was actually treated with plutonium when he traveled from Australia to the University of California at San Francisco to receive treatment of his osteosarcoma. There was also reached a settlement for the children who had participated in the so-called Science Club experiments at the Fernald School in Massachusetts. In April 1988, Quaker Oats and the Massachusetts Institution of Technology agreed to pay $1.85 million to 45 former test subjects. This was a population of boys identified as retarded, whose parents enrolled them in a so-called science club. They were fed cereal, for example, that had been treated with isotopes to study various things like calcium metabolism. And they also received a settlement from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. A settlement was also reached in the Cincinnati Total Body Irradiation Settlement. This was a sort of a dual-purpose study that was conducted, funded by the Department of Defense. These were cancer patients who were receiving total body irradiation ostensibly for treatment of their cancer, but because the Department of Defense was also interested in sort of in the effects of increasing dosages of body irradiation, federal judges approved a settlement for families of patients at the Cincinnati General Hospital. This is a case in which the physician who survived and was named in the suit refused to provide an apology for his participation, continued to defend, in fact, what he had done. One other settlement involving Vanderbilt University, again in the spring of 1998, in which pregnant women who had received what was called a radioactive cocktail, that is a something containing radioactive isotope of iron, again to study iron metabolism in pregnancy, received a settlement of $10.3 million. I'm sorry, I don't mean to offend lawyers, but it always interests me sort of where the difference between what the recipients get and sort of the cost to the lawyers. And this is from a recent article that appeared in the Annals of Internal Medicine, The Rise of Litigation in Human Subjects Research. Interestingly, litigation was something that researchers in World War II were greatly concerned about and actually investigated policies with such insurers as Lloyd's of London about whether or not they could be sued if an experiment turned out badly. And in one case, for example, Harvard University, it was a study of a blood substitute in World War II. Harvard University approached Lloyd's of London, who agreed to insure the investigators and the institution, but the cost Harvard considered was too prohibitive. And yet, in the conduct of these studies, one of the prisoners in the study actually died as a result of the blood substitute injection, and the investigators were very worried that they were going to be liable. The prisoner in question, his mother received a posthumous pardon, and actually his funeral expenses were put onto the grant of the investigator and paid for by the Office of Medical Research. So I'll leave you with three questions to consider. Sort of, well, what standards do we use to judge past experimental practices? And what I think of as an important question for the future, is it possible, I certainly hope so, to protect research subjects and simultaneously advance medical knowledge? And is it possible, or what are the ways will it be possible to have a more equitable or just distribution of research benefits and costs? Thank you. Okay. I have 5 minutes for questions. I think this is a question about how the data has been treated. Okay, certainly there has been, perhaps the most explicit debate has occurred sort of in the context of the Dachau hypothermia studies about whether the information obtained under those circumstances should be used. But, you know, some people have pointed out that there has, you know, that, for example, the data from the Tuskegee syphilis study, if you look at sort of the standard textbooks of internal medicine, things like Harrison's or Cecil's, you'll see that in some of the earlier editions of the study, I mean of the textbook, when it talks about the effects of untreated syphilis, they just tend to quote sort of some of the results of the study. But after much of the public attention devoted to or criticism of the study, there appears a phrase, I think it's in Harrison's Principles of Internal Medicine, bioethicists and historians have called attention to the fact that this may have been treated unethically. So I think that there, in brief response to your question, there are basically three ways that it's been treated. One is to ignore the circumstances. One is to sort of make the statement, we're not going to use the data that was obtained under these manifestly unethical circumstances. And third is to sort of use it with an explanation or to highlight, in fact, that we're using it, but we note some of the costs to the human participants. You know, I think I will beg the historian response, which is, the question is about living organ harvest in China, about what should be done at the current time. Is that your question? Well, you know what? I'm going to leave that to the people conducting this course to address. It's a question about some current practices in China about harvesting organs from perhaps unwilling donors. Maybe donor isn't the right word, sources, bodies. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
We're going to take a 15-minute break and reconvene here at 10:40 for a talk about conflict of interest, financial conflicts of interest. One other announcement here.
Quick announcement. If anybody signed in this morning but didn't give details about email and contact information and wants to receive a certificate, please give that information to the people at the desk. Thank you. Okay, we're going to start the third session for this morning. Again, please remember to turn in your evaluations at the end of the class after you've heard the speakers. So our third speaker for this morning is Dr. Cary Gross. He's an associate professor in the Department of Internal Medicine at Yale University Medical School. And no, we don't have a special contract with Yale for this morning. And Cary's going to talk to us about conflicts of interest in research.
Thank you. And I'm glad there is no contract. That could be a conflict of interest. So. Speaking of such, before I begin, I want to disclose my own financial ties. I have, in the past 5 years, received research support from both Boehringer Ingelheim and GlaxoSmithKline. However, I can assure you that in no way will that affect what I present to you today. What? So this morning I will briefly review the evolution of the medical research landscape. I think this builds very nicely upon Susan Letterer's discussion of past concerns and abuses of the medical research privilege that scientists have. And in this day and age, I view financial conflict as one of the most important and disturbing threats to scientific integrity and to patient protection. Then we'll discuss how financial conflicts can bias science, scientists, and institutions. And finally, I'll briefly review some of the efforts that are underway to repair the system. So initially, I will review the evolution of the medical research landscape. Over the past 25 years, there's been an explosion in medical research funding. Here on this figure, you see, just look at the total size of each bar. Between 1980 in 2006, the total medical research expenditures in the U.S. increased from about $10 billion to almost $100 billion. And if you focus on the size of the black, the middle portion of each bar, you can see that the proportion of these research expenditures that are derived from industry has also been increasing substantially. And now industry-sponsored research outweighs federal research in total expenditures. This investment has paid off in the sense of sponsorship of published randomized trials. Now about 40% of published studies in large, the four major medical journals are sponsored by industry. And just a few point prevalence studies from other areas. A recent survey of community-based internists here in Maryland found that about 22% reported that they had participated in industry-sponsored studies in 2003. So this is not just an issue that pertains to academic medical centers. Now, old data from 1996 is surprisingly no more recent survey data of faculty, but at that time about a quarter of faculty at academic medical centers had received industry funds. 124 academic institutions in the U.S. Reported that they held equity in businesses that were engaged in research conducted at the same institutions. And finally, recently it was reported that about one in three IRB members report financial conflicts. So it's common, it's prevalent. Let's take a step back and define what is a financial conflict of interest. This is a definition that's as good as any. A situation in which the financial considerations may compromise or have the appearance of compromising an investigator's judgment in conducting or reporting research. Now, one thing I want to make clear that in my perspective, the financial conflict of interest is a state of being. It either exists or it does not exist. Now, if a financial conflict exists, or may or may not cause bias, or may not be influencing the state of affairs, but I view financial conflicts the same way I review pregnancy. You either are or you are not. I don't buy into this potential conflict. So let's talk about the fact there are other types of conflicts of interest, however. First of all, there are non-financial conflicts of interest, which can certainly bias science, such as the desire to prove your prior hypotheses were correct, the desire for self-promotion, peer recognition, political agendas, very prominent in this day and age, or religious beliefs. There are several types of financial conflicts, several types of financial relationships. There is the study support, that is, who is actually paying for the conduct of the study. The investigator support, who is paying the investigator's salary to perform the work that is involved in a study. And there are other types, such as patent or royalties, that would be derived from a product if it is found to be useful. Expert witness, there's recently been some high-profile issues where there are concerns raised about the use or a prior experience working as an expert witness could potentially influence what people are writing or saying. And finally, this issue of insider information, that is that too closely knit relationships with the financial services industry where investigators may be relaying prematurely the results of trials. Now, here we are. I want to move on to describe how conflicts of interest can promote bias. And the way I like to do this is to go step by step through each stage of our journey of a new entity from bench to bedside. And I'll do this in reverse. So we'll start at the bedside. And when trying to decide whether to use a new treatment, both the clinician and their patient naturally are going to bring their own knowledge, attitude, and beliefs to the bedside. However, one would hope that scientific evidence also plays a major role in the decision about treatment. So the first way that I'll describe where conflicts can potentially bias care and science is by not letting scientific evidence reach the bedside. An example of this would be suppressing dissemination of evidence. And specifically, I'll talk about the SSRIs. These are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. These are depression treatments. And the SSRI randomized controlled trials in children. So I want to first present to you the published study results of SSRIs in kids. So look on the left side. These are published studies with an industry sponsor. And if you look at the gray bar, these are the positive studies. So there were nine studies which showed that the industry's SSRI was a positive study. It was beneficial. There was only one study that was published that said the results were negative or neutral. Now, the non-industry-sponsored studies of the same agents, their published balance was much more close. So in total, five papers found that these SSRIs were helpful. Four found they may not be helpful. But after unpublished data were made available as a result of litigation and a settlement with the New York State Attorney General, this is what the new balance of data looked like. So as you can see, there's actually now balanced on both sides. And if you look at this, if you summarize all of this, I'm not sure the SSRIs are helpful at all. So think of the implications this has for clinical practice. Now, this raises the issue of publication bias, negative results that are not being disseminated. This happens not just to industry-sponsored studies. There's a natural tendency as an investigator, if your hypothesis was wrong, you're not so excited to disseminate it. Medical journals are also less likely to be excited about publishing a negative study. So one could ask, well, what really is involved in the thought process of an industry sponsor? Is it really the case that these financial interests are guiding decisions? And there was recently a publication in JAMA which leaked, that's probably not the right word, disseminated some internal correspondence from Bayer. This is a different study, nothing to do with SSRIs. This is one of the cholesterol drugs, the statins. In July 1999, there was a small internal study where they were testing a high dose of their agent, cerivastatin, because some of the other newer statin drugs were actually a little more powerful and more effective at lowering cholesterol. So what they did is they tried to raise the ante a little and try an extra high dose of their drug to see if they could reach the same benefit. So what they found was concerning, because at this higher dose, higher than what's on the label for what was being prescribed, there is actually a marked elevation of a muscle enzyme called CPK, and this actually could potentially be dangerous. So 12% of patients had marked CPK elevation. And the decision based upon these results was that internally there'd be no further studies of this high dose of cerivastatin because these findings were clinically important. It was causing a problem. It was scientifically meaningful because they therefore decided to alter their scientific course. But what did they decide to do about the results? Internal document said, the large percentage of patients experiencing CK elevation led to a consensus not to publish the results of this study. So very clear, because there's a problem and a side effect, let's not let anybody know about it. Now, before data are disseminated, before the scientific evidence is actually ready for the world, we need to analyze and interpret our data. And if that is not done in a manner that is consistent with the study protocol, that is described a priori, or is consistent with scientific norms, then bias can ensue. So let me give you some examples. And the best drug class when we're thinking about conflicts of interest are the COX-2 inhibitors. So I'll be describing two major COX-2 inhibitors studies. So the first will be celecoxib. And this study is the celecoxib long-term arthritis and safety study. This was a randomized trial. And just a point of background, the whole point of these COX-2 inhibitors is that they're not really more helpful with regard to treating pain. They were designed to be more helpful with regard to having lower side effects. Regular aspirin, Motrin, Advil, all cause major stomach problems, ulcers, gastritis, etc. So if you could build a super aspirin that would be just as effective for the pain but not cause the stomach problems, you'd be taking a great leap forward. So this is what class was trying to do. You could think of it more of a safety study. So because of that, the primary endpoint in this class study was complicated ulcers. And NSAIDs, that those are the non-steroidals, that by that I mean things like Motrin, ibuprofen. So this is what was published in JAMA. So the incidence of ulcer complications at 6 months. So again, the y-axis here is a percent of patients in each group that had a major stomach ulcer problem. So in the Celebrex group, just look, basically it was about half as much as the control NSAID group. And in JAMA, the manuscript where this was published said, celecoxib was associated with a lower incidence of symptomatic and ulcer complications combined. This was accompanied by an editorial which said, this suggests that celecoxib is effective at reducing the risk of symptomatic ulcers. However, because this prospective analysis was limited to 6 months, careful future analysis will be required. But turns out, even at the time this manuscript was submitted to JAMA, more than 6 months of data were available. At the study's authors had at their disposal the full 12-month outcome data, not 6 months. And this is what the 12-month outcome data looked like. Much less of a difference between the two groups. And let's see what the author of the editorial said when he got a look at this data. I'm furious. I wrote the editorial. I looked like a fool, but all I had available to me was the data presented in the article. And Kathy DeAngelis from JAMA, the editor, chimed in, we are functioning on a level of trust that was broken. So now let's move on to Vioxx, which you could fill a whole 10-session course about Vioxx. Actually, you could make a whole ethical book about Vioxx. Here, what I want to do is call your attention to both the analysis and the dissemination of the results of what is called the VIGOR trial. This is the same type of study that I described with class, primarily a safety study. So what I did, just to make things easy, I abstracted the data, and this is what they found. So roughly 4,000 patients were assigned to Rofecoxib, that's Vioxx. Half were to a regular naproxen, naproxen. So if you look at the top, these are the arthritis, these are patients with arthritis. The arthritis disability and function score went down by the same amount in both groups. And as I mentioned, that's what we expected. The effectiveness is similar. As far as gastrointestinal bleeds, there was a significantly lower risk of major bleeds in the Vioxx group, about half as much. That's the 0.5 relative risk. Complicated major GI bleeds requiring hospitalization were also substantially lower in the Vioxx group. But there was a small increase in the risk of myocardial infarction. Now, this immediately raised concerns. I want to show you an internal document, which was, this was from an email within Merck that was passed after this this study was finalized. It is referring to the MIs. It is a shame, myocardial infarction. It is a shame, but it is a low incidence and it is mechanism-based as we worried it was. So there was preliminary laboratory animal data suggesting there may be an increased risk of myocardial infarction. So this suggests that the Merck team actually was worried about it, and this VIGOR study confirmed their fears. Now let's talk about how the data were analyzed. Actually, they did something highly unusual. The cardiac follow-up data was terminated 1 month early, 1 month before the gastrointestinal follow-up data. So they never explained why. But by stopping their follow-up of the heart outcome early, they were able to exclude three cardiac events. And these were all in the Vioxx group, and which actually this did alter the relative risk of myocardial infarction by changing the analysis in this way. Also, the absolute number of events was not reported in the publication. So that was the analysis, this skewed, unequal follow-up time. But I want to focus a little bit more on the dissemination of these results. So it's very hard to read. I'll read it out loud for you. This is the abstract of the New England Journal publication. So remember the three main outcomes that we're talking about is arthritis pain, stomach problems, and heart problems. So in this study where Vioxx is the experimental agent, rofecoxib and naproxen had similar efficacy against rheumatoid arthritis. Okay, we got that. The respective rates of complicated stomach problems was 0.6 for Vioxx and 1.4 for naproxen. Very clear. The incidence of myocardial infarction was lower among patients in the naproxen group than among those in the Vioxx group. This is a very interesting way of switching around and reframing your data, because what you're saying, because your experimental agent is the Vioxx. Like imagine a placebo-controlled study. If you are having lower incidence of problems in your placebo group, you don't usually say, you know, and placebo actually ended up with less heart attacks. It must be protecting people. So let's follow this through a little more. Now I want to show you in the actual meat of the article, it's absolutely impenetrable. Remember, it was 0.1% versus 0.4%. It's very simple. You could not be more clear. 4% of the study subjects met the criteria of the FDA for the use of aspirin, and et cetera, et cetera. These patients accounted for 38% of the patients who had myocardial infarction. In the other patients, the difference in the rate of MI between the groups was not significant. So they did this post hoc analysis where they tried to carve out who was taking aspirin and who wasn't, and it had nothing to do with their primary study plan. And looking at this, I must admit, I remember when this study came out, I remember thinking, oh, okay, it's aspirin. That's the deal. It's who was taking aspirin. And so I actually continued to prescribe Vioxx because I was duped by this. But then the actual outcome data from the same exact study were available to an FDA advisory panel. And these guys were able to access the data in a primary form. And they published the exact same data in a subsequent JAMA article like this. So here, this is just the incidence of major cardiovascular events. This is the Vioxx group as time goes by. This is the naproxen group. So here, if you see the data this way, you're probably a little bit less likely to go prescribing this for your patients, right? At least I was. So How did Merck respond to these data? They published very quickly a review of internal Merck studies comparing Vioxx to other agents, and they concluded no, as you would expect, no increased risk of Vioxx. I want to point out one thing here. This was received at the highly prominent journal Circulation, October 2nd, 2001, accepted October 3rd, 2001. Now, for those of you who have submitted manuscripts, this is a relatively quick turnaround time, and I've never been able to find the backstory there. But I want to point out a different review of published data from a couple of years later. Same idea, though, was what these authors did, they tried to aggregate all studies comparing Vioxx with placebo. So basically, this is the first study. It's a chronologic order. So this is the very first study. And then you look, as you go to this side, basically, it favors the control group as being more safe. Here, this side would be favoring Vioxx as being more safe. So as time went on into 2000 and 2001, the total summary of all the evidence available was becoming quite clear that Vioxx was dangerous. Now, during this time, from 2001 to 2004, several other large epidemiologic observational studies suggested that there was a risk associated with Vioxx. Annual sales, however, continued to be at the $1 billion mark, and the annual direct-to-consumer advertising was over $100 million per year. This was a big cash cow for Merck. And $100 million, just to provide a frame of reference, that's actually more than Budweiser spends per year. It's incredibly aggressive marketing. Now, as we all know, looking back, this stopped with the approved study. Here, there was an interest in looking at Vioxx as a way of potentially decreasing the likelihood of colon polyps recurring. So they took 2,600 patients, and this was really a colon polyp study, but as one of their secondary outcome measures, they also looked at myocardial infarction or stroke. And what they found was that Vioxx group had an incidence of these major problems in 3.5%, much more likely than in the placebo group. So a quick back-of-the-envelope calculation. If you looked at the total number of patients who were exposed to Vioxx between 2001, when Vigor first came out, and 2004, when it was eventually pulled from the market, if you assume that the risk to patients in the general population is similar to the risk in those studies, it's thought that it's thought about 10 million people were taking Vioxx at that time. And then you apply the same risk, there are roughly 160,000 additional myocardial infarctions or stroke that occurred in the U.S. because of the ongoing aggressive marketing and use of Vioxx. Okay, so one more point before we leave this concept of thinking about data analysis and interpretation. It's important to also analyze data, not from an individual studies, but like I suggested, there are important ways of synthesizing data through meta-analyses or even writing about data in important letters to the editor, correspondences. So this was actually one of the earliest studies of conflicts of interest in data interpretation. And this, what happened was, as background, back in 1995, there was some data suggesting that a type of blood pressure agent, which was called a calcium channel blocker, might be dangerous, particularly for patients at high risk of heart disease. So what these authors did is they reviewed, at the time of this great controversy, all the articles about the safety of calcium channel blockers. They included research papers, reviews, letters to the editor, et cetera. And what they found was that the published opinions about the safety of calcium channel blockers were related to their financial arrangements. So among the authors that had published items supportive of calcium channel blockers, 100% had financial ties with their makers. And then you see it decreased even to the authors who are critical of calcium channel blockers were less likely to have financial ties, but even then, a substantial portion did have ties. Okay. Now, before we can collect and analyze the data, of course, we need to get access to patients. And one concern that has been raised is that due is whether financial conflicts can bias the behavior of researchers in such a way as they might not be appropriately applying inclusion criteria or obtaining informed consent. Now, there are no data that I'm going to show you that proves this. There are anecdotal concerns that have been raised. For instance, this is the most high-profile issue, this Jesse Gelsinger case. Jesse was a young boy with a hereditary enzyme deficiency. He was about 17 or 18 years old. He was actually feeling pretty well, and largely because of a desire to help help others with his disorder, he enrolled in a phase one gene therapy trial. There was a treatment-related death. That was him. And a subsequent FDA investigation found that there were lapses in notifying the FDA about four prior adverse reactions, the kind of information that you might want to include on a consent form. The informed consent forms had been changed, omitting mention of animal deaths without approval, and that Gelsinger's, one of his blood tests, his ammonia level, was above the acceptable level, and on that criteria alone, he should not have been eligible for inclusion in the study. There were also conflicts of interest noted in that both University of Pennsylvania and the PI both had substantial equity in the licensing and sponsoring entity. Again, there's a lot of, again, anecdotal data where people get involved in a trial, something bad happens, and there were conflicts. Here, this is a Seattle Times expose about Hutchinson doctors, including a Nobel Prize winner, held stock advisory positions, and in some cases, jobs with the sponsor. I'm going to revisit this issue, because this raises the issue largely of autonomy, because here, uninformed consent. So we have some data about informed consent and conflicts of interest, which I'll present to you shortly. But for this particular area of human subjects, let me just say that there's not great data out there to show conflicts of interest are an area of bias. Okay. Now, study design bias is the next step in our pathway. One example of a way to design a study that could bias the results is choosing an inferior comparison agent. One published review found a comparison of fluconazole versus amphotericin B. These are two different agents which are used against fungal infection. And the authors found that the majority of patients in studies comparing these drugs were in trials that were supported by the manufacturer of fluconazole. However, oral amphotericin B was used as a comparison agent, which is not the way that amphotericin B is used. It's poorly absorbed. It's rarely used in that manner for systemic infections. Amphotericin B is really an IV drug. So if you're comparing oral fluconazole versus oral amphotericin B, naturally fluconazole is going to come out looking like a wonder drug. So what do you get when you put all this together, all these potential areas where bias could ensue? We performed our own review of studies that had looked at the relation between industry sponsorship and study outcome, whether the outcome of a study was favorable to industry. So each row represents a different group of studies that was investigated, and this is what their aggregate summary estimate of the relation between industry sponsorship and pro-industry results. And when we put all these together, the final result was that industry-sponsored studies, this is hundreds and hundreds of studies now, industry-sponsored studies had a 3.6 times higher odds of a pro-industry outcome than non-industry-sponsored studies. So in summary, financial conflicts of interest are pervasive, they're powerful, clinically hazardous, and a threat to scientific integrity. Now, I'm going to highlight some of the efforts underway to repair the system, and we'll talk about societies, journals, the government, and IRBs, and some of these in much less detail than in others. Professional societies had been one of the worst culprits with regard to financial conflicts of interest, as far as suckling at the teat of large pharma for decades. And now, in the recent past, some societies, such as the oncology, American Society for Clinical Oncology, and others, have actually taken aggressive new stances with regard to at least to their research relationships, prohibiting the PI of studies to have equity in the study sponsor, that sort of thing. There is seems to be a firewall, as I see it, between the society's behavior with regard to trying to ensure the validity of their research. So they seem much more willing to instill policies for that. However, for the traditional clinical care and clinical relationships between pharma and physicians, societies are steering clear. But medical journals are the entity that really have taken the greatest steps to address financial conflicts. And that's interesting, because you could take a step back and think, where do medical journals get the bulk of their revenue? It's really not from prescriptions. A large proportion comes from pharmaceutical advertising. So journal editors are to be credited for maintaining this. Again, they have their own firewall between the marketing and advertising side and the scientific content side. So what have journals done? How would you, as a journal editor, I mean, you're just publishing this stuff, how can you ensure scientific integrity? Well, what they've addressed is three things. Number one, author independence. Number two is publication bias, and also, more recently, objective data analysis. So for author independence, one thing that they were addressing is this. Editors may choose not to publish an article unless the authors have full access to the study data, take responsible for data integrity and analysis, and were free to publish the results. So this is very interesting, because here, what the journal editors are doing is they're inserting themselves into the contract negotiation process, if you think about this, from before a study even starts. What they're saying is, we want to make sure you investigators, before you start out, make sure you negotiate this for yourselves, that you can have access to the study data. And by establishing this policy, it gave extra strength and support to the investigators when they were trying to make these negotiations. Hey, if we can't get access to the data, we can't get published in an ICMJE journal, which covers the bulk of journals. The next thing the journal editors were concerned about was publication bias. Again, something they are, you know, admittedly part of the issue themselves, because they don't want to publish negative studies. They're worried about their own impact factor and catching themselves on the evening news. So how could they ensure that studies are published? What they did is they, through their own requirements for publication, added trial registration as a new ICMJE requirement as of 2 years ago. So before you start a trial, it needs to be registered in a site such as clinicaltrials.gov or another approved site. So the investigators or the sponsor need to register the hypothesis, what interventions you're doing, what endpoints you're laying out a priori. This would have helped with issues such as that class study where they only published the 6-month versus 12-month data. If they had a trial registration, that might have been captured by the review process. Eligibility criteria, funding source. One thing, what's missing from this list? Is the results. Now, certainly the journals don't want to have these results disseminated on the web, because they want to be disseminating them themselves. But one thing that we need to think about eventually is what to do with the unpublished studies if we're interested in their results. And that's currently not part of the dialogue. So this has had an effect as far as the number of studies that were registered, and I think this one is just clinicaltrials.gov, but after the new requirements, there's been a sharp increase in registration. So it, at least based on these data, the journals' requirements do seem to be working. And finally, objective data analysis. This, I'm not sure. I don't know how this is going to work, but here, what the next step was, well, how can we make sure that your analyses are valid? What if you adhere to our, is it from the journal's perspective, what if you adhere to our policies and you say that we all had access to the data, but everyone that was writing the article all worked for the pharmaceutical sponsor. Everybody had access to the data. Still leaves you with a nagging feeling of, well, maybe they're still in the objectivity. So the JAMA policy, as of 2 years ago, said this: industry-sponsored studies in which the data analysis has been conducted only by statisticians employed by the sponsor. In those studies, an independent statistician must be identified and given the entire raw data set, the study protocol, and the analytic plan. Say, here, this is our data, this is what we set out to do, replicate our results. And this statistician must confirm the findings and report such in the manuscripts. I have to tell you, I'm not sure if this is workable, or I've not heard of feedback about whether this this has been happening reliably. I think it's a great idea in practice, but we'll see. As far as the government, I'm just going to try to actually skip over it. The NIH, as where we are, has had a lot of feedback, let's say, since the LA Times published this expose in 2003 showing that several high-profile, highly placed NIH employees had been receiving substantial income from consulting agreements, and there was first an initial draconian set of anti-conflict of interest policies. There was a revision. Currently, the top 200 or so NIH employees have a relatively strict conflict of interest policy, and other NIH employees are subjected to oversight, but not as much prohibition. But the government is trying to. Government is our friend. And IRBs. Here, I want to get back. I promised I was going to come back to this issue of autonomy, of disclosing financial conflicts to potential participants. So let's take this. This is the earliest data we could find. This is just an internet survey of anyone who is surfing the web could have accessed this. And what they did is they asked patients who have different chronic illnesses, if you were approached to be in a clinical trial, would you want to know about a financial conflict, or would you want the researcher's information to be on the consent form? So these patients with different types of illnesses, and the truth is the differences between illnesses are not that important, but the majority did want to know about a conflict. The majority of people said, yeah, put it on the consent form. Less of them said it would make them less likely to participate in this hypothetical trial, but patients seemed to want to know about it. So data such as this and just a general feeling of concern has led to a thrust toward disclosing these issues toward research participants. The AAMC, American Association of Medical Colleges, does say that consent forms should disclose the presence of any conflict of interest and the fact that there's oversight by a COI committee. A recent survey of 120 IRBs did find, however, that only about half of them suggested disclosing as a potential strategy for managing conflicts, and only 4% on their forms actually mentioned the committee oversight. So there's a disconnect between the AAMC and what's actually happening out there. So too many little things here. What about actual study participants? Dr. Emmanuel put together a team, which I was fortunate enough to be part of, where we found patients who were actually did have an illness, in this case it was cancer, and patients who were participating in a research study. So we asked, are they aware of conflicts of interest as an issue? Are they worried about conflicts? And whether conflicts of interest would have affected their decision to enroll? So first, of these cancer trial participants, we asked, in the past 6 months, how much have you heard about financial ties to research? And I just want to point out the mean grade level of education of these trial participants was, I think it was 14 years. So this is a highly educated group. And surprisingly, the majority hadn't heard anything about it. And these are people enrolled in trials. We asked, some doctors running clinical studies have financial ties. How worried at all about you, about your doctor, and we asked again, about your cancer center having financial ties? Just look at the very bottom. 80% said they were not worried about their researcher having ties, and 70% not worried about their cancer center. And would conflicts of interest have changed your decision? Here I'd say just look at the top row, and we let them choose among different types of conflicts. But 75 to 80% of people said that these conflicts various types of conflicts that would not have affected their decision to enroll. Now, clearly this is a biased group because these are people who have already enrolled in a study, so they've made that leap already. But the bottom line is, my interpretation of this data is that patients may want to know about financial conflicts. They may not want all the sordid details about the types of the of conflicts that are present. And I think if we're going to really try to best manage conflicts, just throwing the whole thing into the laps of patients and saying, well, we're just going to disclose it to you and you figure it out, it's not the appropriate way to do it. So in summary, perfectly timed. I don't mean to villainize industry. The point is to raise our level of awareness and concern about the potential bias. Obviously, there are thousands of hardworking scientists with a great deal of integrity and concern working for industry, working with industry. And the real goal is to ensure that we're able to move forward, keeping in mind the long-term goal of improving health and ensuring patient safety and scientific integrity. Thank you. So, 5 minutes for questions. All right.
Hi, I have a question concerning the increasing funding from foundations. So like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, these kind of things. Do you see any conflicts of interest there at all?
I'm sorry, say one.
Do you see any conflicts of interest arising in that context at all?
I missed the beginning.
In foundations, there's increasing funding research from foundations. And do you see any conflicts of interest in that at all?
That's a great point. I think conflicts of interest, as I mentioned, could stem not only from having a financial stake in the outcome, but also having a firm belief in a hypothesis. Or, if a foundation has been doing work in a certain area, like a new AIDS vaccine, you become so tied to this vaccine, that could it could potentially affect the way science is the research studies are designed or interpreted. But foundations, I think at least the high profile ones have a pretty good system of external review in place before funding major initiatives. But yes, no one's immune, and foundations certainly need to think about this as well.
Yes. How much does actually disclosing financial ties ameliorate conflict of interest?
That's a good point. I feel like it doesn't at all. Disclosure is, first, two research participants, as our data suggested, it's probably not going to make a major difference on their willingness to enroll. However, a lot of the numbers I was presenting with 80% said they wouldn't care and 70% said they would have enrolled anyway. There are some people out there that do care and would not have enrolled. So there is a possibility that a minority of patients do think about this seriously. One interesting study, which I'll describe, was they looked at the impact of disclosed financial conflicts on readers of medical journal articles. And this was a British study that took a BMJ article, and they made two identical versions. Everything's identical, except at the very bottom, they made up a company. This was sponsored by whatever company. And then they asked people to read the article and rate the scientific validity and the importance to society. And there was a tremendous difference between the two groups. So the readers of journal articles, actually, based on that one study, do seem to discount the integrity and importance of industry-sponsored study. That's why I feel industry needs to really work hard in partnership with us, because the last thing they want is their own research to become discounted just because their name is affiliated with it.
Well, okay, that's my question, because the data you showed are accurate. That is, industry-sponsored studies are now a greater proportion of the total than NIH-sponsored studies. It means a lot of money's been put into it, a lot of effort, a lot of academic institutions are engaged in it. And if you discount it solely on the grounds of the financial incentive, you're throwing out a lot of research. So maybe there's another way of repairing it. The other thing I think one ought to use some caution about when displaying some of the biased reporting that we've seen is that it isn't confined to people who have financial conflicts of interest. We've seen a lot of biased reporting, so that real numbers maybe are a better way of saying how many of those where there was a conflict of interest showed biased reporting, just instead of showing some of the most egregious errors.
The if such data were available, that would be great. All we can do, unfortunately, we're actually bound at this point by litigation, unearthing these secret emails, and I'm sure that there are similar emails in the world of the non-for-profit academic research where there's a PI somewhere that says, "Oh, let's not let anyone know about this negative result." But the preponderance of the evidence that I showed is quantitative, and it does point to a strong link between the behavior of the sponsor and trying to guard their investment.
Hi, I actually have worked for the FDA for 10 years, and I think what's interesting and perhaps maybe should be included in this discussion of conflicts is the importance of an unbiased and supported group of sort of federal scientists who review these data. And I think it's also important to highlight the fact that when you see conflicts often between FDA assessments based on review of original data and countered by citing publications of similar data where there don't seem to be matches, I think it's important that perhaps a little more understanding of the FDA processes and the fact that original data are reviewed, independent statisticians re-review, and that sometimes the wars that take place in public are because of re-evaluation in an unbiased manner of data by the FDA, which don't happen to agree with data published by people with conflicts of interest. It's more a comment than a question.
No, it's a good point. I think more funding for the FDA to be more independent would help along those lines as well.
In your last slide, you made the comment that the people are being asked a question about how much they trust the researchers or how little concern they have for the financial ties. We're already participants, so that might be biased. Would you compare that? Maybe it's similar to the phenomenon of people who trust their own particular representative or senator,
yeah.
But as a whole, they think they're pretty corrupt. Would it be similar if the question was asked more generally of researchers or doctors as opposed to ones they were participating in?
That's a good point. So the question was whether people responding to a question framed at their own researcher or a doc would respond differently than researchers in general. And I bet we would have had significantly different results. But I think people would have been more likely to say they distrust researchers as a whole. But the focus of that study was really about you and your doctor and whether you would participate. So that biases the feelings of generalizability, but allows us to focus on that person's actual decision based upon their own experiences. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you all. Don't forget to turn in your evaluations, and we'll see you next week at 8:30 right here.